Good morning or good afternoon, depending where you're joining from. And thank you very much for joining today's webinar. Today we are diving down into the rabbit warren, also my favorite topic at the moment, which is post-quantum cryptography, quantum computing. But this but today and this time with a slant towards PCI and how it affects CDE environments, card data environments. Looking at everything from crypto agility, the migration that potentially we need to look at, and the post-quantum roadmap to 2030. We've been talking about quantum computing at our conferences that we've been running around Europe and Africa, and which we're taking over to North America later this year. And also the Caribbean. I should call out for any of our Caribbean customers. And we've been asking the question, quantum hype, quantum threats. But I think across all of those conversations we've had, it's very clear that there's a quantum threat that's on the horizon. But how far on that horizon? For those of you that are starting on your quantum journey learning, don't worry, we are going to kick off with a little bit of a primer to allow everyone to catch up and understand the challenges overall. So don't worry, you don't need to be a quantum computing expert for this to apply. So just before I kick off and introduce my co-host for today, I will just call out some of the housekeeping. There is a Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. Please make use of it, ask questions, and put us to the test. This is being recorded, so you'll have the ability to watch back, share as you like, and the recording and the link to the recording will be sent out as a follow-up to this webinar. And lastly, for those that wish to use it, we have the translated captions available to you. So without any further ado, I'd like to welcome Martin Petrov, who is our CTO for PCI and Integrity 360. Martin is a senior executive with vast experience, 20 years plus experience in technical leadership, consulting, and building high-performance professional services teams. A respected information security expert, he's helped many major organizations embed security into their culture and maintain continuous compliance. And his compliance around the payments card industry is where his true expertise comes shining through, and he's been a key figure in that area, right back to version one of PCI DSS. And I think we might touch upon it a little bit later. He's one of our attendees at the GEAR meetings, helping shape the PCI standard, and heads up, is the figurehead of our PCI practice. So, Martin, very much welcome to the webinar. Obviously, we'll be going through some of the elements, but it's great to have you on board. So, let's kick off. In terms of the format we're going to run, we're doing a combination today of talking around a number of topics, but very handily, we've got a set of slides that'll help articulate that. So, Martin, let's kick off with the first question, I guess, and particularly from a payments card perspective. We'll have a number of people that are in that area. Why should they care? Let's kick off that discussion around quantum computing, post-quantum cryptography. Why is what is the big deal, particularly from a PCI perspective?
Good morning, everyone, and good afternoon, whatever you may be. Thank you, Rich, for having me here. This is a very interesting question, and probably many of you have heard kind of the more cliche reason for this, which is how either well-funded state organizations or massive cyber criminals, not so much your average basement hacker, applying the so-called harvest now and decrypt later principle when those computers actually come to real existence. And the more important reason from a payment card industry perspective is to complete the migration to a post-quantum cryptography. We will need quite a few years, and we've learned quite a few lessons with historic migrations. I'm sure all of you remember the move from magnetic stripe on the card to chip and pin. I'm of the opinion that we are still migrating to that pop-up in e-commerce transactions that additionally authenticates that you really are who you say you are when performing an e-commerce transaction. So it really is those two reasons. One is the migration timeframe, and the second one is when those computers have appeared, it would be just too late. You'd have a huge potential debt of data having been harvested.
They are key threats, particularly because card data is long-lived data, and yeah, which if we're considering threats that to encryption, that harvest now, decrypt later, is focused on longer-living data. But obviously, and I'm pretty sure that most people on this call, particularly people in the PCI field, will be well aware that underlying cryptography is the key to securing payments. As we're kind of depicting there on the graphic. There's a huge piece of trust, and it's going to affect multiple areas of how we secure payment cards. So I guess the question really, I don't know if you wanted to come in on that, Martin. I saw you ready to jump in there.
Yes, actually, most of us, when we think about cryptography, we really think about protecting or securing data. And cryptography actually has two major areas. One is protection of data, but the other one is establishing trust, establishing identities, authentication between the different components of the ecosystem. So what we have here on the screen is a few examples where not just data encrypted either at rest or in transit, but also establishing trust and authenticity. So for example, when a card is touching a contactless reader or whether it's being dipped for the chip being read, the terminal will want to authenticate and make sure that that card is authentic, that it hasn't been cloned. And all of that happens through digital certificates and that kind of process of authenticity. The same or similar process takes place between the terminal and the payment gateway and the payment gateway's infrastructure. That may be either some kind of an application server, or in certain instances, it can be a hardware security module that has to authenticate that the payment terminal is authentic, it hasn't been tampered, and so on. But also, many of us forget another area of trust, which is so critical. And this is the area where whether those are software or firmware-based updates, when you want to update, let's say, an application, when you want to update a piece of hardware, such as a POS terminal, ATM terminal, HSM, you really want to make sure that that piece of firmware is authentic and it really comes from the vendor and it hasn't been tampered. And all of those examples actually rely not so much on the encryption as much as on the fabric of trust, which cryptography as a whole provides. And this is what is actually very much a threat by quantum computers.
Yeah, I think that's one of the areas that probably gets skipped over a little bit, because it's not just a PCI problem. Obviously, whenever you install something, you see, I don't know, it's signed by Microsoft, it's signed by whoever. I mean, being able to fake that, as you say, there's so many different layers to trust that there's the potential to be eroded over time. And just to move on, I think why, and I think you touched upon it a little bit, but it'd be good to go down, why can't we wait until Q Day? I mean, just in terms of Q Day, obviously Q Day is that supposed day that quantum computers, or I always forget the exact term for it, but effectively a viable quantum computer that could affect cryptography suddenly comes into being. Now, I think many talk about that could be many stages. Talk about, well, actually, who's going to have one of those? I mean, obviously, we talk about Google. They have theirs in a data center, which is the coldest place in the known universe. But what we don't know is nation states and, moving on to threat actors using them to their advantage. So going back to the question, why is it that we can't wait until that day arrives?
Yes, we really cannot. Kind of my recollection of the start of migration from the magnetic stripe on the card to the chip is probably something that took 10 years. And depending in which part of the ecosystem you sit, whether you're a merchant, whether you're a service provider, maybe you're an issuer or an acquirer, you would have different kind of needs and different infrastructure and processes and technology that would be affected. And not only did it take a long time, but it was complex because it had to support the old legacy, the new one. It probably took a good 10 years to roll out globally. And again, just going back for a second to harvest now, decrypt later, many people kind of take the whole process very simplistically in a sense that, oh, the average plastic card has an expiry date within 3 to 5 year time frame, and that will automatically renew. But assume that you are waiting now and are doing nothing, and quantum computers are inching ever closer. If next year a breakthrough happens, many of the cards will be as many as 3, 4, 5 years out, still available. There's also a number of processes, a number of software pieces, hardware components that also have a very long refresh cycle. And all of them depend on cryptography, whether this is kind of the trust component or whether it is the encryption. Secrecy. Organizations will need to kind of plan for this, and there's also ways how either well-funded nation states harvest data, or also massive cyber criminals that they target very specific data that is long-lived. So kind of waiting and doing nothing is not a good strategy. Probably in many ways the way it was for the migration to chip and PIN. And similarly, another migration that has been even to a larger extent much more software based, even though it did have hardware impact, is that move to that so-called 3DS, 3D secure authentication for e-commerce transactions. That is still not present on every e-commerce website. That is still not rolled out to every cardholder. So yeah, it's just a process that we have learned from the industry that has so many dependencies and so many possible places to break that we just really need to plan it and plan for a long migration. And the migration also has, I'm happy to talk a little bit about that later, a number of issues that are much heavier and much more difficult than historic migrations.
I mean, you talk about that the migration to Magnetic Strip. I think it's also, what I found was very regional. I mean, I was shocked to have my card swiped and having to sign for it when I was in the States, not that long ago, to the point of where I couldn't remember what my signature was, as we use it so rarely these days. So obviously that was, such a surprisingly long migration. And there's challenges there that that will cause that. Now, just moving it on, and just particularly as a part of the primer, very, very, very briefly, let's not go down into too much of a rabbit warren of quantum computing, but how did we get there? What were the where are we now? Where's it come from? And a little bit of what the differences are.
Sure, this is like really cool history just to know for everybody's education. So a long time ago, we started with mechanical ropes, pulleys, and gears to build the very first mechanical calculators. And then came the first electronic machines, which were built on these hot valves that really guzzled a lot of electricity, and a computer like this would take a whole room or even more. And then we discovered the transistor. And then we discovered how to miniaturize the transistor and put it on silicon. to a point where I think most people don't realize that today the density of transistors on silicon goes as much as 30 billion transistors per square centimeters. 30 billion. So an Apple M4, the latest chip from Apple is M5. We don't know how much transistors does this have, but the M4 has as many as 100 billion transistors. And if you put one transistor to be the size of a grain of sand, you can cover a whole stadium with that. That's how many you have. And quantum is kind of the next leap. We're moving now onto atoms or particles of light, photons. And it must be noted that basically we moved from one substrate, from one basis of where we do the processing to another, which caused the leap. And it must be also noted that there's a significant difference between quantum computers and the so-called classic ones. Quantum computers are not just another leap in speed and performance. They're kind of completely different beasts. And they are very good at certain computations and calculations that classic computers are not. But conversely, they're not a very fast classic computer. So there is still place for the classic and for the quantum. But that's kind of a little bit the history that, is quite mind-boggling and
Yeah, no,
the
indeed.
level
You
of
know,
miniaturization that we have.
those. Well, that's it. You say a grain of sand. You measure transistors in the single-digit nanometers. So so tiny. So, and you sort of talked about the differences. I think nothing, really describes that more than the maze analogy. I don't know if you want to kind of just walk us through that. And I guess, is it all down to it as well?
Sure, what we can see here is basically a classic computer trying one path at a time. And a quantum computer is a little bit like you can imagine water flooding the maze all simultaneously. And it basically figures out the one correct path. This is an analogy. It's not actually completely scientifically true. It's complicated, and that's why it's used an analogy to explain it in layman's terms. Maybe just one more level of detailed explanation is essentially the algorithms of quantum computers. What they do is they use this process of interference, where, if I can explain it, they basically cancel out all the wrong possible paths so that the only good path is amplified and given as an answer. Even this is not super strictly scientifically, perfect. But the principle is quantum computers can do this, complicated things in such a way that they cancel out all the wrong answers, if I can put it that way, singling out the good one. It also must be noted that classical computers are actually quite good at solving maze problems. And a classical maze problem is when you put in your navigation app destination A to destination B. The app figures out what's the shortest path, through many different combinations. So there you go. The maze is just an analogy to help explain a little bit the difference between classical computer trying one path at a time versus the massive parallelism of quantum computers.
Yeah, and as they get more powerful, then that'll speed up and be able to do much bigger and larger mazes. So let's move the conversation on, and let's talk about the impact. Now, the impact that we've alluded to is down to cryptography and that ability to break the cryptography that we have in place now. We've talked about the fact that it provides trust. It provides the data in transit. There's also data at rest, and obviously the difference being between the types of encryption. So I guess the question, and I was kind of called out there, does quantum break all cryptography equally?
The short answer is no. And actually, what I found fascinating when I was kind of researching the topic is that it impacts completely different the so-called symmetric versus asymmetric algorithms. Super briefly, symmetric algorithms are most commonly used for encryption or for secrecy, and the asymmetric ones are the ones that use to provide trust and authenticity in digital signatures, in your TLS certificates on a website and so on. And the major difference between those two is that the symmetric uses the same key to encrypt and decrypt, whereas the asymmetric, that's why the name, actually uses two different keys. What is actually very special is that there's two scientists. One is called Peter Shor. Invented a quantum specific algorithm which actually attacks asymmetric algorithms. And it doesn't just speed up the time, it just completely bypasses the whole process of trying different combinations and all of those kind of things. And the most common, well-known asymmetric algorithm used not just across the payment industry, but just finance and everything that has to do with security, with integrity, with authenticity, is the so-called RSA algorithm. So that algorithm is completely destroyed and weakened by Peter Shor's algorithm. And this is what basically quantum computers do. On one side, with regards to the payment card industry, they destroy all of that trust. Everything that helps authenticate, is the card legitimate, is the POS terminal legitimate, is the firmware or the software that I'm installing, are those tampered with and are they authentic? And then there is a second algorithm, Grover's, I forgot the first name of the scientist, but this one actually attacks symmetric algorithms. And what it does is it essentially, in very plain terms, reduces by half the strength of the algorithm. So if you have the so-called and very popular, most of you would have heard that algorithm, AES, Advanced Encryption Algorithm, standard, sorry, AES, with a 128-bit key, essentially Grover's algorithm will reduce that strength to 64-bit, which 64-bit is known to be brute forcible with classic computers. So this is kind of what is not talked very often, that quantum computers essentially completely destroy the digital trust, the fabric of the payment industry, and they significantly weaken the secrecy. One notable kind of ray of light, of shining light, is that the AES algorithm with a 256-bit key, when attacked with Grover's algorithm, will have an effective strength of 128-bit. And this is, by today's classical computers, this is considered strong enough. So very technically speaking, AES 256 is officially considered post-quantum ready. So
well,
there's
there you go
something
from it.
Interesting that hopefully somebody, some of you learned today.
Yeah, well, John, you're talking about post-quantum readiness. Let's move the conversation on and look at, and again, let's keep it. We'll keep it as brief as we can. Look at post-quantum algorithms that you know are available. So, do you want to just touch upon those, Martin?
Essentially, industry bodies, for example, the NIST in the US, have actually published post-quantum algorithms. A lot of complicated 2-3-letter abbreviations. You don't need to worry or remember them. There's algorithms which are specifically designated for secrecy or for encryption, and there's other ones for keys, for trust, for certificates. And conversely, also European Union regulatory bodies have also issued such keys. What is notable is that those are not tried and proven. And those were selected as part of a process where candidates proposed by different bodies were selected. And what's kind of really curious to know is that some of the post-quantum candidates actually were cracked with classical computers. By researchers. One of them is called, if I'm not mistaken, Rainbow, and the other one was Psych or something like this. So yeah, those were post-quantum proposals that were actually cracked by classical computers. So they haven't been tried and proven and tested through time the way RSA algorithm has been now maintained scrutiny for over 50 years.
Yeah, and is it possible to even do that? That's, I guess, that's the challenge that that we face. So just let's talk about start shifting that angle further towards PCI, payments infrastructure, cardholder and card data environments. Where, although we're calling out here, but it's important to understand that actually cryptography exists across the estate.
I think that many people simply don't realize the numerous places where cryptography, which consists of secrecy and authenticity and trust, exist. Most of us associate it with encryption of the PAN, the PIN, of course, and some other sensitive elements, either in transit or at rest. But actually, there's a lot more going on when a transaction is performed, whether this is an e-commerce or card present transaction. I mean, just one small example here to pick the plastic card. When you are flying in an airplane and you pay for a snack or for a drink, this is considered an offline authentication. The terminal is not able to speak at that point in time with the payment gateway. So, kind of the whole authentication between the card and the terminal happens without any external interference. And for a lot of that to be able to happen securely, reliably, and so on, you actually need a bunch of asymmetric algorithms and processes. Another one is, as I mentioned earlier, you have all of the different types of POS terminals, ATMs, and also HSMs. All of those are being updated with so-called firmware, which is a type of software for hardware devices. And all of this depends on signatures, digital signatures, to authenticate the authenticity of that firmware. But so is the so-called key loading into POS terminals. So once a POS terminal leaves the manufacturer or the personalization center where initial keys are injected, all of the other operations have to happen remotely. And both those and those operations require both symmetric and asymmetric algorithm and processes to, provide that security. We talked about the formerly, they were called SSL, now they're TLS certificates for websites and e-commerce. Also, many people forget how many mobile wallet and applications there are. And those also have their cryptograms and tokens and whatnot. And what's also becoming very popular now is more and more merchants are able to accept payments via commercial off-the-shelf devices. So taking a mobile phone that meets certain hardware requirements and installing a piece of payment processing software to enable them very affordably to accept payments. This has also a ton of asymmetric and symmetric algorithm and processes to make sure everything is safe and secure. So an organization may have so much in their estate that they need to think about that if you don't kind of approach this very systematically and early on, you have a big chance to be late and suffer the consequences.
Yeah, indeed. That was a bit of education for myself. Even I didn't understand or have an idea of actually how much cryptography is actually in from an AES and from an AES, from a symmetric and asymmetric. Just I noticed there that Fabio Pizzomiglio, if I've Spanish, has just probably put the name of it of Grover and it's Love Grover. I mean, I assume that's a name and not just a statement that of love towards towards the Grover algorithm. So just we've touched upon it already. It might be worth just to going back to it and just I guess lessons from the past in terms of migration. I don't know if there's anything you want to add on top because I know we've kind of discussed it already in terms of the what we've seen that we've been challenged with.
Actually, there's quite a bit to add. Why is it harder at a technical level? So what we see here on the screen is some mind-boggling facts. So it's often not about performance, requiring faster hardware to perform more computations. It is more about actually the size of the keys, the signatures, which can be a magnitude of 10 to 100 times bigger, which creates an additional problem where you need bigger bandwidth. And it's not the bandwidth that you think about your internet connection at home or a data center or something like this, but it's the expectation that when you tap your card in the metro station, that you will get the barrier open within a second, the most two. So imagine now you have to transmit 10 to 100 times the size of the data between a contactless card and the reader. This is a completely new paradigm in terms of hardware and performance. Then you have the problem of having both the historic or classic algorithms being supported and living next to the post-quantum ones. So we need more storage, potentially different computation capabilities. You need bigger buffer sizes and memory. So actually the impact on everything in the ecosystem, especially all of the hardware components, is quite big. And it's not just probably the smallest bit to worry about actually is the performance. It's more the transmission, the bigger sizes of the data. A lot of the po post-quantum computers are, sorry, algorithms are just as fast as RSA, but it's more these additional elements that are very disruptive and make it very, very difficult.
And on that, can we trust the algorithms? You talked about some of the early ones that went through those NIST assessments that that we that were assumed, say we they assumed were quantum safe, but actually they were cracked by classical computing. Where do we get to?
I think the biggest lesson here is that we don't know what's going to happen when the quantum computers come along. When the researchers, in combination of having the hugely developing AI together with quantum computers, what new methods of attack and algorithms will come up. So this is actually, the reason, the underpinning reason why we need to build the so-called crypto agility, which means the ability to be able to swap algorithms and to be very diverse in what is possible and what is supported. Because who knows what will happen when quantum computers come and the FIPS 203 and 204 standards, just like Rainbow and Sykes, get compromised, and you have to do now a whole complete refresh. So we really need to be not monolithic. We need to be really kind of thinking in terms of we need flexibility, or as the industry calls it, agility.
Yeah, that's a really important point, because that in I guess two directions. One is, when it's a challenge to be to migrate existing systems, but it's also getting ahead of it to make sure anything new that's being developed isn't just being developed, I say, in that monolithic way, that encryption is entirely embedded, but needs to be modular so that we can swap in and out. Invariably, we will find that these algorithms, as you said previously, they're untested, and we'll find that they aren't as secure as were first expected. So we will need that ability to change in and out as we need. So look, we've talked around a lot of the challenges. We don't want to scaremonger in this instance. Let's talk about what to do. And it brings us to a nice area, a point to kind of start finishing on. The question is, if you ask what do I do Monday morning, which gives you a few days to wait until it comes round from today, but what are the practical steps? What should we be doing now?
So number one is a bit of a cliche, and most of you would have heard it. It's doing inventory. But that's kind of oversimplified, and that doesn't do the subject justice. Taken into the context of the payment industry, you've seen a few examples of, in particular in that case, a number of hardware components. So just be sure to look at every single component in your cardholder data environment, whether it is a software, whether it is a hardware one. You need to inventory everything that does cryptography. And remember, cryptography is not just encryption. It's not protecting the PAN in a database. It's not just the HSM because it's easy to remember. There is usually a lot more processes around it, loading keys, replacement key ceremonies, and all of those kind of things. The same for POS terminals, so ATMs, if that's what you're running or operating. So the inventory is, on one hand, everything about cryptography, and the second part is about data, long-lived data. Obviously, the PCI industry has made a lot of strides to an effort to ensure that keys are regularly replaced and refreshed, that anything has kind of an expiration date and is evaluated on a regular basis to make sure that it's still able to withstand the current threat landscape. And that's about inventory. The other two and three are probably not as much spoken about. I feel very passionate about it. Most organizations, I'm sure, that are present here and in general would have a large dependency on third parties, either for software or for hardware or for services. And a big part of the preparation is ensuring that your suppliers and vendors have a clear post-quantum computing roadmap. You need to make sure that they have plans how to address all of those issues to prevent you, what step three suggests on the screen, is to stop buying tomorrow's problem. There is, in fact, already a number of vendors, particularly for hardware and for HSMs, that have upgraded the hardware, the memory, the bandwidth, and all of those kind of things to support the currently approved post-quantum cryptography standards and algorithms. So this is one good example. And last but not least, as part of this overall process, as we mentioned in the previous slide, is you need to make sure that you have that agility in case one of the algorithms gets compromised and defeated. You need to have the ability to quite rapidly respond to that and perform the migration and the change without requiring huge investment and downtime or suffer some security breach. That's kind of what we need to try and do. And number one, as I said, is a bit of a cliche, but with the context that hopefully people have gotten now, you need to go and look at your environment much more properly and adequately.
As it says along the bottom there, you can't migrate and you can't protect what you cannot see. And I think there's a couple of pieces for me there. I mean, although we've got these as numbered in terms of a priority order there, but actually the as with all things, everything's a priority. But as getting towards quantum safe and being have that post-quantum cryptography in place, it's a team sport across an organization rather than just falling on one single team. So there a lot of these things, we should be looking to kick off in parallel to make sure that we're moving that along as possible. As you say, working with procurement to update that, working with our auditors and the people in the organization that are doing third-party risk management, providing them with the questions to go and ask, and then educating development teams that are developing new applications. At the same time, you still need to look at old applications, but that kind of fits into point number one there, to make sure that they are looking actually, as it says, they're designing for agility and designing for tomorrow. So let's look at wrapping up before we go to the Q&A. I think we've probably covered a lot of this already, but I think what is the takeaway? That it isn't, as a call out there, it's not simply let's go and swap algorithms because it's not as simple as that. It's it is a in many cases a payment infrastructure migration across all of those boxes that we've got there. And I the most important takeaway, and I've actually heard it said many times when I've been talking to customers and experts in the industry, that best time to build that, not just the inventory, but your approach and start on it was yesterday. The next best time is today. And as with this, as with many things, you can be a day early, but you can't be a day late. So with that, I'm just going to move on. Before we jump into the Q&A, just call out that we have some upcoming webinars and events. We have a webinar coming up tomorrow on Mythos, looking at what we should be doing in response to Mythos today. Obviously, we had a lot of hype back in March when the announcement was there, but how has it played out and what should we really be focusing on right now? And then we have our Security First conferences. So we are wrapping up our first leg of those conferences in Paris on the 24th of June. So if you're in the Paris area or close by, please register and join. Obviously, we have a QR code there for registering for all of these events. And we'll be kicking off our second leg in the autumn in Brussels, Calgary, and Barbados that is on that list there. So let's jump into the Q&A. We have a few questions that have come in. Please ask. We do have a bit of time, so ask away if you've got anything else to answer. I'm going to answer the first one that's just come in there, or the last one that's just come in there. Cash is king. Should I just hide all my money under the mattress?
Yes.
Double thumbs up there. Get a nice big mattress.
You need a bigger mattress, probably. But yeah, I mean, you will raise some suspicion going to the bank, so you probably need to spread it out and think about the transport. No, it's probably
You sound
better
like you've
to.
done this before, Martin.
Yes, I watched a lot of movies too. But yeah, no.
Well, I think the other aspect that of that is, and it comes back to trust. You talked about it at the very, very start of it. It's all based on trust. And talking to one of the largest banks in Ireland and the team that's looking after it, and this was probably about 18 months ago, and we were talking about trust and that the ultimate fear, that Armageddon scenario, is that quantum computing comes in. We're not ready for it. People can't trust their transactions, and the fear will drive organizations, or sorry, organizations drive people to want to get their money, their hard cash out, rather than their virtual money. And obviously, as we all know, we've seen runs on the banks previously back in 2008. I think we saw a lot of it in the credit crisis. And so we all know there isn't enough notes and coins to cover virtually all the money that we've got. So there's a big challenge. So I guess get ahead, be the first one in the bank to get that cash out. Might be the argument there. As I say that, it reminds me that the other piece that's been talked about, what is the what else relies heavily on encryption, and by name that's cryptocurrency. Now, I think the threat's a little bit further off from that, but I think there's we could, potentially we can't say the next step, quick first step, is to put everything into crypto, because where is that going to end up? So, and just to call out, we're not industry regulated for financial advice, so don't take any of this to heart. Okay, let's move on to another question that we've got here. Is my P2PE setup suddenly going to become obsolete? Should I be thinking about a complete overhaul, replacement of all my POS terminals?
I think the short answer is yes, if we had a quantum computer, unless, for example, it has kind of a P2P is a solution. It's a combination of multiple components. You have the encryption by the POS terminal. We have a decryption environment with HSMs. Unless all of those have been properly upgraded or updated with post-quantum resistant algorithms, it is very likely. I mean, the whole idea of P2P is that you can transmit the sensitive cardholder data over any media and protocol, not worrying about its security. So as we've seen with the attack on symmetric algorithms, where the effective key length is reduced by half, and then anything that's asymmetric or the trust piece being kind of completely defeated. The short answer is, yeah, you technically speaking, you wouldn't be able to benefit from the reduced number of controls which a P2P, let's say, merchant and environment can enjoy. You essentially would be moving back to the so-called SAQB-IP, which is basically a terminal that doesn't guarantee the encryption of the data over untrusted networks, and you have to, take some other additional measures. So yeah, it would be okay. I'm not going to say the word devastating, but it would be, yeah, definitely a problem.
Yeah, and I wonder if that will vary from vendor to vendor, and talk about what to do Monday morning. Third party risk management, understanding what's there, and what is their
Supply
roadmap.
chain.
Is it something that actually we've got, is not going to affect us, and do can we implement, besides all the fact that we might need to go and replace all those cards with a chip that can support it, if it can't already. So just actually, do you know what, there was a question I was going to ask you actually. So just in case we run out of time, if any questions that we've got in the Q&A don't get answered, we will follow up with written answers to those questions. So please carry on putting them in. But one thing I was going to ask you, Martin, I mentioned at the start that you'll be one of our representatives at the next Gear meeting, which is relatively soon, isn't it? I think not too far off.
If you're talking about the year 2030, is that what you mean?
Well, as in what I'm thinking is that obviously the gear meeting for developing PCI. I think there's one relatively close around the corner.
What's quite really in time with this webinar is we have this global executive assessor roundtable meeting, 30 top QSA companies meeting with the council tomorrow. And out of three topics that are in addition to the standard agenda, one of them is post-quantum computer algorithms. And also, this is not coincidental because the so-called PCI PTS standard version 5 was just published last week or a little bit before that. And it absolutely talks about and includes post-quantum algorithms. And today we're at the so-called stage where those are recommended, recorded, and not required. But kind of the expectation is that this is just a preparation cycle. And undoubtedly, with one of the upcoming versions of that standard that very much affects and regulates most of the hardware that does cryptography, so everything that goes into an ATM or POS terminal, and HSMs also, has to do with symmetric and asymmetric, and those things will need to support post-quantum. So at the moment, they're the permitted, recommended. They're talking about running classic alongside post-quantum, hybrid key transport and all of those kind of things, but it's definitely in the top three topics outside of the regular agenda.
Yeah, and
Yes.
that really, quantum computing is often, a challenge to talk about because it's not tangible. But that's going to make it tangible very, very quickly. I won't push you on your view on where that's going to end up because I think we'll run out of time. I will say that's got to be also driven by the advancements in quantum technology that we're already seeing. Cloudflare and Google have completely cut their time when they expect to need to be quantum ready. It's about 3.5 years away when they have to be fully covered across the board. So I think that was very interesting. I will just cherry pick a few questions that have come in. Given the advent of AI and quantum cryptography, very much set on observations changing the state of information we are sending, are there plans to place leverage in place to leverage this to essentially cancel transactions based on unexpected quantum state, for lack of a better word? I hear a lot about it, but see little development here.
So yeah, this is, I mean, this is a pretty sophisticated question. I think it relates a little bit more to quantum-based communications, where you basically is by today's standards and understanding, it is impossible to intercept quantum-based communications because the moment you observe such a communication, you alter the state, and that essentially tells the other side that there's been eavesdropping. If I understand correctly the question, and yeah, it's, I don't want to say it's a little bit theoretical. I think that quantum communications is like really for state actors and really sophisticated level of communications, but even though the question at this stage and development of quantum computers is a little bit theoretical, I wouldn't be able to definitively say yes or no. I think that it's a little bit depends and depends on what is the kind of the risk level. It kind of reminds me a little bit of how even in today's transactions, let me take an example on e-commerce transactions, how the different parties that process and authorize perform different risk scoring checks, based on IP address and difference between the language of the browser, the location, the IP address, and all of those kind of things to kind of compute some kind of a score to determine, should we allow this and should we not allow this. So I wouldn't be surprised if kind of interception and change of quantum state would be a trigger to cancel such a transaction on the assumption that I properly understood and answered the question, because I think this is less about quantum cryptography, but it's more about quantum communications.
Yeah, no, indeed. John, we've got a few questions in now. Just question here is, with quantum, would attackers try to exploit possible only known encryption algorithms? Would it block if we use our own encryption algorithms shared only between partners?
I think the answer can be responded to in two ways. One of them is, well, it depends how interesting the data you are transmitting is and if it's worth going the extra effort to defeat it. This is one. The second one is kind of a classical response is, if your algorithm is self-made and it hasn't been kind of tested and subjected to public scrutiny, there is also a chance that it's maybe fairly easily defeated. So you also walk the risk of having some weakness of something that you haven't been able to properly account for or think about.
Yeah, take, I
So
mean, like take a considerable resources and effort and expertise, mathematicians to go down that
build
path,
it
and
reliable.
also it'd be very, very hard to keep something secret, particularly when it's being shared between parties. Just I guess, we'll probably leave it there. I'll just call out that quick note from Giorgio there too, that mentions that actually. Yeah, probably obviously data lifecycle management, that I just got off the top of my head the exact term, but collect now, decrypt later, can be not mitigated but eased through lifecycle management. If you don't need it, don't store it. But many organizations will approach that anyway. But very hard in some instances, particularly healthcare, for example, where there's extremely long-lived data. So there were just one more question, but we'll follow up on that afterwards because we are approaching the hour. I appreciate everybody's got the busy days. I probably want a couple of minutes between their next meeting. Martin, Thank you very much for this session. Hugely insightful. Great to chat about it. Could use another hour of people's time if they'd lend us our ears, I'm sure. And thank you very much to everybody that's joined today. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich, and thank you for everybody who joined. Have a good day.